Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Here's one of several two-word reactions I had while reading the Reverend Julie Johnson Staples bio. Holy cow. To share the rest, I believe, would be irreverent. Sorry. Currently, the Reverend Staples is interim minister for education at New York's Riverside Church. In 2010, she graduated from Harvard Divinity School. The previous year, she received a Master of Divinity degree from the Union Theological Seminary. The Reverend Staples also has a law degree from Georgetown and got her undergraduate degree at the University of Kansas, where she majored in journalism. Early in her career, she was the Justice Department correspondent for ABC News and the Supreme Court correspondent for Time magazine. She's also worked as a White House correspondent for the New York Times and Baltimore Sun. Reverend Staples appeared as a panelist commentator on CNN and Company, This Week with David Brinkley, and Washington Week in Review on PBS, just to name three. She's president of Johnson Staples and Company, a communications and public affairs firm. Julie was also managing director and partner of Warburg Pincus, the global private equity firm. Additionally, the Reverend Staples was the executive managing director of Hill & Knowlton. She's also a member of various boards and organizations and has been a visiting professor and a guest lecturer. It is my pleasure and honor to welcome Reverend Staples to the 51%, but unfortunately we've run out of time.
Thank you for having me. It was wonderful to be here.
I have to tell you that when I got to the section of your resume that read references available upon request, I burst out laughing and thought, are you kidding me? Who in heaven's name would need references? But seriously, I read that you spent most of your life in active lay ministry. Mm-hmm. But what was the catalyst that really fueled your desire to be ordained?
I jokingly say that I left Babylon and turned to heaven. But honestly, it was a surprise to me. At the time, I was working as a partner at Warburg Pincus, which was extremely rewarding. It was challenging insofar as I spent most of my time traveling, most of it internationally.
Doing what exactly?
I was responsible for global marketing, and what that means in a private equity context is that we provide consultative services to our portfolio companies so that if you're going public, if you're developing new product, if you've got issues management concerns or crisis communications needs, all within my department, if you will, came PR, advertising, marketing services. And since Warburg Pincus invested across life stages, so from venture to late stage, there are a vast number of opportunities to provide support to the company. So either that could be naming, look and feel and branding identity, or it could be issues management around shutting down a plant or product tampering or things like that. And so there was lots of opportunity to do a lot, but I wanted to do more. And also, I guess I consider this to be consistent with my entire career, which for the longest part, I guess you'd say, was journalistic. Mm-hmm. And again, pursuing in small ways justice, but the sort of move from journalism covering politics, to journalism covering law, to working on Wall Street, which provided me an opportunity to have resources to write checks to causes that I cared about. Uh-huh. And then I really found that check writing wasn't enough. And so I wanted to actually get in there and do. The other thing I found, and this is a global issue really, is that people are looking for meaning. People want to be part of the world. The people want to care about things, even as we've seen family structures change and in some cases disintegrate. Religious community structures aren't what they once were, say, in the 40s or 50s, but yet people still want something more. I've always been a Christian believer, mm-hmm. and I was raised in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. So I've had, in the early days, a very eclectic Judeo-Christian experience, since most of my work was international travel and a large part in Asia. In my later years, I became very involved in study of Eastern religion as well. And I was actually at my church. My home church is Plymouth Church in Brooklyn Heights, which was founded for the abolitionist preacher Henry Ward Beecher. And I was in a Sunday school class, and they were teaching the apocalyptic writings of Daniel. And I had never really studied Daniel. So I decided to take a walk on the wild side, living in Brooklyn as I do, took a taxi all the way up to Jewish Theological Seminary, and just went into the library and started pulling books. So I actually, on a lark, applied to seminary thinking I would learn more about the Old Testament. And as it turned out, I wound up becoming, at Union, an Old Testament major, but because that's not predominantly studied in Christian seminaries very much, I wound up spending a lot of time at Jewish Theological anyway, which is right across the street from Union. So, and I studied Hebrew, and I continued that at Harvard.
But when you went to the Theological Seminary, were you still working full time?
Okay, let's see, when will we call I retired? I was still working full-time when I applied to Union, and so I only had a full-time role at Warburg Pincus for 3 months, because by the end of 2008, I resigned from the partnership, and so I started at Union in August, September of 2008. So I had classes early in the morning, then I'd go to Warburg. When it comes to education, sometimes I'm a little nuts. And it's ironic that God has now placed me as a minister of education. That is my vocational call, mm-hmm. to be a partner to people who want to continue to learn. So I love learning. And I had said when I finished law school after that, 4 hours a night, 5 night a week, 4-year haul at Georgetown, that I would never go to graduate school or go back to school again. But here I find myself, I'm just pulled in wanting to know more. And if I could study all day long, every day, that's what I'd do. I'm actually getting ready to launch a Bible study on the book of Jeremiah. And our opening, or I was working on the syllabus while I was on holiday, the opening will be a geostrategic look at Syria and the situation right now in Syria, but through the lens of Judah. And if you remember the book of Jeremiah, the story is Judah is like making alliances with Egypt, and they're making alliance with Syria, and then they're getting desperate, and they're trying to do all this sort of political maneuvering and military maneuvering, and yet the Babylonians come in and conquer them. And then
everything old is new again.
Everything old is new again. So anyway, long story made short, I was sitting in my office at Warburg Pincus, and 3 course catalogs were on my credenza for 3 years, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. I did nothing with them. But one time I was on a
seminary
holiday.
School. You
seminary,
mean.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. I just decided, well, let's just take the subway uptown. After I did the Daniel thing, and when I was at JTS, I saw Union. I had never even really heard of Union. I slightly knew that Adam Clayton Powell had attended there and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but I knew nothing about Union. But anyway, I went up, I applied, I got in. So then I had a 3-month overlap with Warburg Pincus and school, meaning me attending. The 2009 year, I remained as a consultant to Warburg Pincus, and that's why I founded and created my consulting business, J. Johnson Staples & Company, so I could continue to support Warburg Pincus in a reduced capacity while I went to school.
To be, no pun intended, the devil's advocate here, did they think you were nuts at Warburg Pincus to give up this Tony job with this, you know, a very impressive title to study religion?
Well, it's interesting because at my church, again at Plymouth, there were 3 of us going through an ordination process at the same time, meaning a call to seminary, mm-hmm. and then a call to ordination. The only one of them was a man. There are 2 gals and a guy. The guy, who's a longtime friend of mine, who actually is serving now as the interim minister over at Plymouth, he was at Goldman. So he wound up going. Now, he did
it. Goldman Sachs, for those who do not know.
Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. He wound up doing it quite differently. He did not share with his professional colleagues that he was going to school at night. He went to a different seminary in night school. So it took him 9 years. So he and I graduated at the same time, but we'd meet sometimes at River Cafe and sort of say, hey, how's it going? But he was sort of doing it on one track, very slow, little class at time.
Toe in the water kind of thing?
Toe in the water, but also because he wasn't able to necessarily or chose to not tell his colleagues. However, I told my partners. They knew, actually, that they would call me religious. Mm. They knew I was religious when I came in. Mm-hmm. And there was no problem with that. At one point, you know, there were Orthodox observant partners and, you know, our meetings would have food choices arranged to be supportive of that and affirm that. So to answer your question, I don't think anyone thought it was crazy to study religion. There is a great respect, I think because Warburg is such a global firm, there's a great respect for different cultures. And so they didn't think it was crazy.
Well, not in the sense to study religion, but did they know that you were going to trade in one hat for another?
I think that, you know, I had a conversation at the Four Seasons Hotel with a former partner of mine who also left Warburg and went to start his own hedge fund. And he's like, I heard you were going to become a minister.
Exactly.
So in that sense, perhaps it was a little, well, unique.
Okay.
People do come and go through investment firms all the time. Mm-hmm. And they typically leave to go do something in, you know, philanthropically, or leave to go do something, even raise children if they're of a certain age, or leave to go, you know, another partner of mine just left Warburg, has bought a sheep farm in England. I mean, people do sort of different life-changing kinds of things. I guess in that sense, it's unusual that I left. I may be the only one in history who left to become a minister. But on the other hand, I'm the first African-American woman partner in history at Warburg Pincus, too. So there are a lot of
firsts
there.
How did this go over in your personal life? Obviously, you didn't drop a bomb in your husband's lap. I'm assuming you had his full support.
And still do. Although it's very challenging, I'd say, to be a minister's husband. Okay.
Be like when we get a woman president and be the first man.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's this portion of me being in school. Actually, my husband's on the editorial board of The New York Times, and I knew him previously before marrying him. Mm-hmm. I knew him because I had also worked at The Times.
Right.
And so I left The Times to go to Time magazine, but in part because I had been in the application process for law school. And so Brent, my husband's name is Brent Staples, he knew I'd left the New York Times and went to school. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, in that sense, if you can imagine the same currency, people would say, are you kidding me? You're leaving the New York Times, your lifetime dream job. I had been a White House correspondent. I had been wanting to work at the Times since I was a teenager. And I wound up only staying 3 years at the Times because I had an opportunity to go to law school and cover the United States Supreme Court at Time magazine. So I did even then leave something that seemed like dream come true for school. So in that sense, it wasn't
the die was already cast.
Well, it wasn't a big bomb in his lap because he knows that I'm willing to do kind of unusual things for school. The bigger unusual thing was when I decided after I finished Union that I hadn't had enough Hebrew study and that I wanted one more year of study, and I chose to apply to schools, all of which were not in New York. That was the bigger
issue,
bite of the apple,
sure,
because I wound up getting admitted to Harvard University, and that meant we were going to need to be commuters for a year. But he totally rolled with the punches. I got him a nice little travel bag, and that was sort of my entryway into, hi, sweetie, I'm not going to be coming home for a year. And so he got on the Acela and came up to Boston, and we had a wonderful, wonderful year with me living in Cambridge, and it was an awesome experience.
And how did that work with children?
I only have one son. I have a son from a previous marriage, and my son is currently getting a philosophy degree at the University of Central Florida, so Justin doesn't live with us.
So that was not an issue, and that's wonderful.
Right. I mean, I do sort of make a little joke about Justin, that Justin has now been to so many graduations with me.
Child is the father of the man here.
Exactly. I mean, because I went to law school later. I mean, he wasn't at my undergraduate graduation, but he was there for my law school graduation as a little boy. He then later flew up to New York to be with Brent for my union graduation. And then he flew up to Cambridge to take pictures and stuff at my graduation.
That's
from
a wonderful
Harvard.
Contrast.
It is. And then just this past June, a couple of months ago, I graduated from something called the Congregational Foundation for Theological Studies. And it turned out that the denominational conference was actually in Orlando, or at Disney. And so Justin was able to, again, come to one more graduation to take pictures. And I actually received the denomination's highest award for scholarship for my master's thesis and research into multicultural religious life in 17th century America.
Wow.
So, you know, I love learning, and I couldn't be happier. So my husband has been supportive. My son is supportive.
Wonderful.
And I couldn't be more thankful.
Now, what do you see as your mission? Well, maybe we should just say what exactly you do at Riverside, because you are interim minister of education, which fits into your global plan.
Right, exactly. The Riverside Church in the city of New York was established in 1930, and it has always been rather vast in scope as against traditional small parish churches or synagogues, insofar as there's a minister of education, there's a minister of mission and social justice, there is a senior minister, there is a minister of membership care and parish life. So it's a multi-staff religious institution in that way. My focus in education sort of takes me from babies to the senior citizen home, insofar as we have nursery services during worship and special events, child care. We have children, youth, and families ministry that reports into the Ministry of Education. So that would be your more traditional Sunday school or Sunday church school. We also have a Friday Night Live fellowship program, which is an outreach to the neighboring community to provide youth some activity.
What's the neighboring community?
The church is at 120th and Riverside Drive. So we're in the Morningside Heights, Harlem community, depending on how you define boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
But we have youth that come from the surrounding community for the Friday Night Lives. This is really teens.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have adult Christian education. And so that can be any age from, say, 18 to 88 or 103. I mentioned, I think, a moment ago that I teach Bible study.
Mm-hmm.
I also have been teaching introductory Hebrew at the church. We offer for free of charge Hebrew and also introductory Greek. Because as you may know, the Tanakh was written primarily in Hebrew and the New Testament was written in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
So for those individuals who are interested in studying the Bible in its original language, Riverside is amongst a small number of churches that offer that as part of the religious education. And then there are all sorts of other programs and questions and that we look at. So, for example, I'm sponsoring in the Ministry of Education a forum, a conversation with an MIT professor named Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder. He was an outside advisor on my thesis when I was at Harvard, but he's got a forthcoming book called Ebony and Ivy, and it looks at slavery's interactions with the Ivy League colleges. And we have lots of other educational programs. I did earlier this year a Bible study around unjust imprisonment tied to Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, as well as the Martin Luther King birthday. And I finished that up with a conversation with four of the five previously incarcerated gentleman that we generally call Central Park Five.
Oh, and a documentary.
Yeah, and we showed the film, and we had Sarah Burns, and we had them talking, and actually Dr. Wilder's...
For people who don't know, this was a huge case in New York City about a woman who was raped in Central Park. The young men who were arrested had nothing to do with the crime.
Yes, and they wound up being arrested and incarcerated, some for up to 13 years.
Right.
And so that's another way that education can provide interaction with in a broader community sense.
Could I have come to this?
Absolutely. And same with the Ebony and Ivy event. So, I mean, this is the church where Martin Luther King came and delivered his prominent speech declaring the Vietnam War an unjust war. Martin Luther King preached there several times, and a number of others. Nelson Mandela has been there. So it's got a very rich history. And in my capacity as the interim minister of education, I'm constantly looking for opportunities to help people answer their questions, life's questions, but through the prism of the Bible primarily, but not solely. We have a what you might call small group Bible study called Living the Question. And one thing that's awesome about Riverside is, first of all, it's international, it's interracial, and it's interdenominational. So it is dually affiliated, but it welcomes all. And so people are willing to and able to come ask questions about the Bible, about patriarchy, about empire, and wrestle with those questions, but in a theological way.
I want to know how you feel about organized religion. And do you see a future for organized religion?
The gentleman who was going to be my academic advisor at Harvard but wound up taking another position out in Indiana, so I wound up having another wonderful advisor, but he wrote a book called God Against Religion. And I really wish we could get to the point in our conversation where we could decouple God from religion and experience God as love. And if you can see that bigger picture of love and God, perhaps you can get beyond the differences that separate us, whether it's racial, whether it's creedal, whether it's denominational, or whether it's religious. Recently, I don't know if you know the internationally renowned Indian mystic and guru named Amma. She was at the Javits Center here in New York recently. Her ministry is hugging people to express love. And she's hugged like 32 million people around the world. I went to that because I'm interested in experiencing God in a number of ways. Now, I am unambiguously Christian. I believe in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, as the Messiah. Having said that, though, I'm able to respect other religious traditions because my mission here is to be a light of love and expression of love. And I don't have to wrestle with you don't believe like I believe, or neither do I have to proselytize you to believe just as I do. But if there's something in my life that can spark something in you to seek God yourself, I think that is the mission. That's enough. And so in that sense, is there yet a place for organized religion? I say yes, because organized religion and tradition is the place where we can go and aggregate to find like-minded individuals who are interested in seeking God. It is possible you could be at your gym. I just left mine. And we could go from the, you know, elliptical to the treadmill to the weight room and say, do you believe in God? You feeling good about it? Or in the yoga room. But how that manifests itself to build community with you, not so sure. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I ran into a young woman at the gym this morning, and she knows I'm a minister, and she was having some challenges, and we wound up talking for 10 minutes, and it would be absolutely equivalent to a pastoral counseling session had she come to me at church.
Right.
But she knew I was a minister so that we could have this conversation and that I could experience an opportunity to say that I would pray for her, and I did that at the gym. But the reason I say there's yet a place for organized religion is typically people come together around the Bible at a synagogue or at a church or at a mosque. They don't typically do that in the subway or at the gym. Perhaps we'll get to the point where we are really meeting people at the forefront of their lives where they are. And I do believe, certainly in ancient Israel and in early Christianity, that is the way the religious life unfolded. It was just life.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't some building until some later point when a temple, you know the story, Solomon built a temple. There wasn't some ecclesia building called church until much later in early Christianity. But I do think that as a guiding principle, there's a place for organized religion.
If we could just switch gears for a minute, how much did you love being a White House correspondent and a Supreme Court correspondent? You must have had wonderful experiences at covering President Reagan.
I've had wonderful experiences. I just recently had the opportunity in our pastoral prayer at church to pray for Helen Thomas and her family because I certainly... served in the Reagan...
UPI, United Press International,
longtime correspondent.
White House correspondent.
Who just recently passed away.
Right.
It was an amazing opportunity to not only cover the White House, but cover it from two perspectives, meaning covering it from the Baltimore Sun is different than covering it for the New York Times. There is no leaking to certain size papers. There is to, and I had a joke actually with Larry Speaks, who at that time was the White House press secretary. I later served with Marlon Fitzwater, and I even recently just got a note from him because he saw my first sermon in the nave at Riverside live streamed on our website. And so he sent me a note from where he's living in Maryland in retirement. But when Larry was the press secretary to President Reagan, he called me up once I got to the Times, and I said, well, Larry, I've never heard your voice on the phone. He goes, oh, Julie. I'm like, you never called me when I was a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. You're calling me now because
right.
I'm at the New York Times. But I made a lot of friends, a number of whom, as I mentioned, Marlon Fitzwater, I still count as friends. It was wonderful to be a journalist. I believed in it. Covering the Supreme Court was interesting, amazing.
Court was it?
Rehnquist, but I covered the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings.
My gosh. Can you just share how you felt about that?
At that time, I was in law school, and so some of the professors from Georgetown were actually advisors to her. On the other hand, I had friends who were friends with him. And so, and actually, once he was confirmed, and so just all cards on the table, I went to a party celebrating his getting
appointment.
Yeah, his appointment. So there's a picture somewhere in somebody's scrapbook, not in mine, but that shows me standing right next to Clarence Thomas and Virginia Thomas at a party. I think that was, and his whole tenure on the court, actually, and I wish we had more time. We'll talk about it some other time, perhaps.
Yeah, you'll have to come back for sure.
Part B. I think his elevation to the court was difficult and tragic in a number of ways, insofar as whatever actually went on between him and Anita Hill became a distraction that didn't let actual examination of his legal opinions get perhaps the full hearing that they should have. And then once he got on the court, he was presented always in lockstep with Nino Scalia, or Antonin Scalia, who's also an associate justice, which also was probably inaccurate jurisprudentially. But honestly, I'm on the opposite side of the table from him on policy
mm-hmm.
and on judicial interpretation. But I do believe that race... played a role in that whole episode in a way that was unfortunate. I mean, obviously, that seems so far in the rearview mirror now because I actually also covered the retirement of Justice Thurgood Marshall. And for me, what a giant. And we're now just having gone through the 50th anniversary of the 63 March on Washington.
Right.
My mother led the Iowa delegation to that. I covered the 20th anniversary of that. And so in one sense... even remembering the Clarence Thomas hearings, I think more about the time I was able to spend with Thurgood Marshall, or the time I was able to spend interviewing Justice Brennan, or just giants in civil rights and who really reshaped America at a point in time. As you know, we're now going to a different point in time. I mean, my husband has spent the past 5 years writing about stop and frisk. Riverside Church has been very actively involved in pointing up the injustices of the way the New York City Police Department has understood the legal precedent, Terry versus Ohio, and in the minds of our congregants, in my mind, and in the mind of apparently Judge Shira Shinlin, unconstitutionally been stopping people in New York City. So just the arc of history, to quote Dr. King, is long, but it bends toward justice. And so I now, both as formerly having been a journalist, pursuing stories of justice, going to law school myself to inform myself so I could properly interpret what I'm seeing, and then now even in ministry, still see justice as the unifying red thread through my entire professional career.
That's a great way to end. It was really a pleasure to meet you and learn so much about
you.
I'm sorry we couldn't just go on for days.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Oh, again, my pleasure. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.